Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Bijou Banter in the KRUI studio. We got Orson Codd.
Greetings.
And myself, Matthew Ho. Unfortunately, Daniel Rager Hoyer could not make it here today. And we originally said we were going to talk about, Charlie Brown Thanksgiving and Spencer, but unfortunately, we've all been very busy right before Thanksgiving break. Mm-hmm. It is currently Friday, October 19th of 2021. So we decided we're going to do something a bit different on today's episode, and we're just going to have a free-form discussion about just anything we've seen recently in the past month or so, just because we talk about a lot of movies here on Bijou Banter, but there's also a lot of stuff that we frankly either don't have time to see or discuss on the show due to the limited hour that we have, or there's just not much to say to cover entire episodes. So this will give us that opportunity to just talk about anything that we've seen in the last month or so. What have you been seeing recently, Orson?
Well, I guess because we just talked about it a couple seconds ago, and I know we both saw it. It was that Halloween film, Trick or Treat. I watched that recently, and I think it's a really fun film. It sadly never had a sequel because I just don't think at the time when it came out, it got a lot of like love or attention. But you know, as time went on, people started noticing it and became kind of, it got a cult following. And I know the director, who's gone on to do some interesting things. I really liked his film Krampus, and Godzilla King of the Monsters was okay.
Oh, he did that?
Yeah, he did.
Oh.
So he's always said he wants to do a sequel, and he's written a script for it, but it's just never kind of happened. So who knows if it will. But, you know, I've revisited the film a couple times, and I did with my girlfriend right around the Halloween season, and it's so fun. Like,
it is.
It's not like groundbreaking or anything in terms of like anthology horror films. But I think, and I liked your Letterboxd review too, it's just a very fun film where you can feel that fall atmosphere to it.
Yeah, for those that don't know Trick or Treat, it's an anthology horror film set around Halloween. And basically, it tackles everything that makes Halloween Halloween, like from the costumes, trick-or-treating itself, candy, ghouls, and like monsters. It's like, it is like the textbook definition of a Halloween film. It is technically a horror film, but it's more along the lines of like, it's like the ultimate movie about the season. And I don't think it's like an amazing film. It doesn't like break.
Yeah.
It doesn't push any new boundaries or any way, just because anthology horror films have existed for decades at this point. But that one, I just had fun. It's a quick watch. It's only about 80 minutes or so. And it flies by. And you know what you're getting into. It's a fun movie. And I really enjoyed it.
In terms of what it does really well, that sometimes I watch a lot of horror anthologies. My good friend Michael and I always around the Halloween season kind of watch anthologies, and then we'll say like to the other person, like, oh, you should check this one out or something. And so that's always fun. I've seen a lot, and I think what this film does really well that sometimes anthologies fail at is connecting the stories together well in like a good, smooth way where it's not like they're clearly just saying like, the stories are connected this way. It actually like they blend into each other. Like, you know, there's the guy who played Dr. Kirk Connors in the Spider-Man, and you follow his story for a little bit.
Oh, that's who it was.
Yeah.
I feel like I've seen this guy before.
Yeah. And then you follow like Brian Cox, who's like kind of the nosy neighbor. So you kind of intercut between those two stories. And I don't want to give any more away because some of them are a little spoiler-ish.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, yeah, I think Trick or Treat's a really fun film. And the main guy, Sam, he's kind of gone on to become like a horror icon. I actually have a Sam magnet on my fridge. So it's kind of
really?
Cool. Yeah. It's like the Halloween rules. I don't remember what they are off the top of my head, but they say it at the very beginning of the film. But yeah, I love Trick or Treat. It's like always a fun film to watch around the Halloween. It's one of those movies, because my brother was talking about it with me a few months ago, and he's like, should I check this out? Because we have the Blu-ray. And I was like, I think this was around like March or something earlier this year. And I was like, don't watch it now, because I guarantee you for your first time viewing, you will not be able to experience it the right way. It's truly one of those movies one must watch if they'd like to during like, I'd say September to October. You can't really watch it any other time of the year, in my personal opinion.
That's a good point, just because, well, we've talked about it too, it's so rich in that atmosphere that if you watch it during like Christmas time, it would defeat the entire purpose of even watching it.
Yeah.
It's like, there's movies that are about the holidays. Like, for example, Die Hard is technically a Christmas movie, but you could really watch it anytime you want. Like, you could watch it in the middle of summer.
Yeah.
Or you could watch it in like the spring. Whereas Trick or Treat, it's like, you can only really watch that movie around Halloween, specifically close to Halloween.
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
Even if you watch it in like October 1st, it would not be the same.
No, it's just, again, we said it many times, it's just so Halloween centric. Like, I think it's more, in my opinion, more Halloween than Halloween. Like, Halloween's got like that, you know, you still feel like that's another movie you can really watch around the fall season. But I feel like Trick or Treat just more embraces like the kind of fun nostalgia with like all the decorations, the sweet treats, the atmosphere, the fall, whatever. So yeah, it's a fun movie.
It really is. And speaking of other fun movies that were around Halloween, another movie that I saw during that time was Army of Darkness.
Oh yeah.
Because we talked about Evil Dead 2 last month, and if you want to check out the episode, it's on the website if you would like to. And we briefly discussed it, and I've been wanting to watch Army of Darkness for a while now because I'd seen Evil Dead 1 and 2, and I really liked both of them. And I also liked Army of Darkness, but it definitely felt like the outlier of the three, because it's still just as fun, but I feel like at times it was a little too over the top.
Too silly.
Yeah, I mean, it was still very funny. There were some really good moments in that. Like, it's very much like a Three Stooges film in a way. But there were at points where it kind of felt like it lost a bit of the magic that made the first Evil Dead in particular so special, like that indie horror film of like a bunch of kids coming together and making this movie. Army of Darkness is definitely the most studio-based out of all of them, because I think it was by Universal. And I don't know how much that movie cost to make, but I'm sure it was the most expensive.
Yeah.
But it was still fun. And I know there's two different endings to it.
Really?
I think there is.
Which ending did you see?
The one that I saw it on HBO Max, and it was the runtime. It was like 80 minutes.
It's a short movie.
Yeah, but like I know there's another cut. It's like the Hail to the King baby ending.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I saw that one.
Oh, really? You didn't see that one?
No, I just saw whatever was on HBO.
Huh. That's interesting. Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, because we had done that episode where we reviewed Evil Dead 2 in preparation for the Evil Dead movie screening, and then after that on Sunday, Halloween, I'd gone home and like was carving pumpkins with my family. My dad was like, oh, you know, your mom and I watched Army of Darkness again last night. And so we kind of talked about that. And, you know, I get my Evil Dead love from my dad. And I appreciate Army of Darkness. It's definitely, like you said, it's the most silly. Like, you know, the Evil Dead is a horror movie that's got comedy. Then Evil Dead 2 is kind of a mix. It's a horror comedy. And then Army of Darkness is just a full-fledged comedy. There's not really any horror in there. Unless like you're a little kid, like
not really.
Too much. Like there's maybe like some tense scenes, but like it's pretty silly for the most part.
Yeah, I don't even know like what I would categorize Army of Darkness. Like it is labeled on Wikipedia as a comedy horror epic, which is partially true, but it's like the horror is so loose in that movie. It's like there are some creepy moments and the whole basic watching Evil Dead 2 and then this back to back.
Yeah,
you get more context behind that, but it is definitely more just like a medieval sort of comedy almost, but not in the way like Monty Python and the Holy Grail. So
it's clearly very inspired by Monty Python and Three Stooges.
Yep, definitely.
I think I said this on the Evil Dead 2 episode, which it still bothers me now that I know this fact, is that the working title for that film was Medieval Dead.
Medieval Dead.
But they, you know, the evil part was spelled E-V-I-L. I love the title Army of Darkness, but I think they should have gone with Medieval Dead, because that would have been so much more cool. And like when you get the Blu-rays all together, it's each one has evil in it. Where Army of Darkness, like the logo is really cool for it, but I think Medieval Dead would have been a cooler choice. We could have made it Medieval Dead Army of Darkness.
Yeah, that would have been kind of cool. I think too, it would be easier to associate it with the Evil Dead movies. Because Army of Darkness, it's like if you're not familiar with the series, you might not even know that it's related to it.
Yeah, and the Danny Elfman score too is also really good. I just remembered that.
Yes, it is.
I'm trying to recently, in terms of horror, this was past the Halloween season, I got a little sick, not COVID, just that fall kind of sickness. And so I had to take like a week off from classes and everything. And I was like, well, what do I do? And I was like, well, I recently found out I had an HBO Max subscription for who knows how long before that came to my knowledge because of like cable provider or something. I don't know. And so I binged all the Nightmare on Elm Street films. I'd seen the first, obviously, which is very iconic. And I'd seen the remake from about 11 years ago, and that was just not that good. Jackie Earl Haley, I think is his name. I don't know. He's an actor. He was good in it. It was an interesting choice, but the movie was just itself a train wreck. I don't know if I can literally actually say what they did to the character, because it's that inappropriate on air. But they do something with the character that is just terrible. Like what they made him do to the kids, if you can catch my drift, was just not, it was stupid. I don't know why they did that, but I binged all the other ones and they were okay. What I found about them was they get very silly after a while, which a lot of those kind of horror movies from like the 80s kind of did when they had like, you know, Friday the 13th 6.
Right.
They get, it's more from moves from scary to like silly Freddy, where like a guy gets trapped in a video game and Freddy starts playing him as the character in the video game. 6 did actually have I think one of them, it was either 5 or 6, actually had a nice cameo from Johnny Depp. That was kind of fun. But yeah, 3, The Dream Warriors, a lot of people really like. That one was actually pretty fun. And then what was interesting was Wes Craven came back and did New Nightmare. But what he did with that was he made it very meta. So it's about where Freddy actually comes into the real world and he's torturing like Wes Craven and like, I'm blanking on the actress's main name, but he's basically playing with all like the people that made the original movies.
So it's like adaptation, but with Freddy Krueger.
Yeah, kind of, because they're trying to make a new Nightmare on Elm Street movie after like 10 years since the original came out. But because Wes Craven's working on a new Nightmare on Elm Street movie, it brings him into the real world. So, And people are like, is she crazy? Like, is she just so much of a fan or whatever? So they're okay. They're worth checking out. I think there's some maybe that are worth skipping, but 3 and New Nightmare are really actually kind of good sequels.
Yeah, I've always seen the original one from... was it 1984?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that one I saw last year for the first time, and I really, really like Nightmare on Elm Street. It was one of those movies that it was sort of like, it had this notoriety behind it, like amongst kids at my elementary school, like, oh yeah, it's the scariest movie ever.
Because the song, like the kids would sing the song in elementary
school.
Yeah,
it's like, I mean, it's nowhere near being the scariest movie I've ever seen, but at least in my opinion. But I was impressed with how creative it was.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't just like a cut and paste slasher film. They actually played with a lot of different themes and also ideas too, and I was very impressed actually with just the whole presentation of it and just the dream angle too that I really didn't expect going in. So I was like, wow, I was very surprised by this.
Yeah, they're fun movies. Again, some of them just get really silly and kind of what you're saying, they're cut and paste. Like, I think after like 3 through 6, you can kind of assume where each one is going to go. Like, you can be, oh, Freddy comes back and then they fight him and then he dies and then kind of rinse and repeat until New Nightmare. But yeah, Dream Warriors and New Nightmare. And 2's okay. A lot of people don't like 2. I thought 2 was okay. But yeah, I'd say they're worth checking out around the Halloween season if you'd like to.
Nice. I guess since we were originally going to talk about this on this episode, but I believe you didn't get a chance to see it, it was Spencer, which is the recent film from Pablo Larraín. And it is a fictionalized account of Princess Diana of Wales, who's played by Kristen Stewart, and how she decides she wants to end her marriage with Prince Charles. And I remember seeing trailers for this and sort of the buzz that it got. I believe it was at the Venice Film Festival. It got a lot of critical praise about it. And it looked like it was going to take the biopic in a different direction and be a bit more psychological. And it definitely did. And I was blown away by that movie. It was really, really good. Mostly because it's not afraid to show sort of like the dark part of royalty, because royalty, it's very elegant and positive in some ways, but there's actually this incredible amount of just really heavy subject matter and also just like, I'm trying to think of the word, like just sort of differing ideologies when it comes to like family, romance, like, and also just connections with other people too. It explores all that. It's not afraid to show that. I think that's what I really respect about the movie. And also, since everyone knows who Princess Diana was, but in this movie, you really got to get a sense of her personality and also the emotional turmoil that I guess she experienced. And Kristen Stewart, it gave an incredible performance. I think she deserves the Oscar for Best Actress, to tell you
really?
The truth. Yeah, she transforms into Diana, and kind of like what happened with Robert Pattinson, because they both of them were in Twilight, and that was like that's what they were known for, and they were kind of shoehorned into that stigma of like, oh, they're in Twilight, so they're bad actors. Like,
but
no,
not shoehorned, pigeonholed.
That's the word. Yeah, it's like, oh, they're bad actors because they're in Twilight. It's like, no, they actually are very talented actors, but they were directed so poorly, and they were given such bad scripts to work with. But it shows if you have the right director, the right script, and the right character, they can transform into that character and also play them so well. And that's what Kristen Stewart did with Diana, and it was very, very impressive. It also just had a beautiful presentation with its editing, its pacing. The costume design was also incredible too. It was just an all-around great movie, and I really liked it.
Yeah, a friend came into class a couple days ago and he had seen it and he was talking about it. I haven't seen it yet, maybe I will, but he said it's like, he compared it a little bit to Joker from a couple years ago where like they kind of, I don't want to be rude, but this is just what he's saying. Like, she's going crazy a little bit in it, where like she'll just see people that like maybe aren't there. Is that like happening?
There are some moments like that where it's like, it is definitely more of a psychological experience, which really? I didn't really expect going in, and that's why I think I was so impressed by it, just because I was not expecting that angle. And the way they handle it, too, it doesn't feel exploitive in any way. It comes from a place of more just stress and turmoil, not necessarily like a like any sort of mental illness, because there was controversy about that with Joker, how it's like, oh, it glorifies mental illness, and it just showed, like, they made a character that became the Joker as, like, a crazy person.
Yeah.
Due to, like, an illness like that. But I don't think that's what Spencer's trying to do. It's just trying to show that the emotional part of that, that comes really? With being a member of royalty and that pressure, I guess.
I do definitely want to see it, because it seems like you're saying they take the cycle. He compared it to Black Swan too. He's like, the second half becomes a little bit like Black Swan, if you've seen that film.
I haven't seen Black Swan.
Oh, well, yeah.
I want to see it though. I've heard a lot of good things about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, he compared it to that. And who knows what his notability, is that the word, like how reliable he is in terms of like how someone can describe a movie? Because sometimes you can talk with someone and they just, it won't add up all the way.
Right. Yeah, but we're going to move into a quick PSA and we'll be right back with more Bijou Banter. Welcome back to Bijou Banter, where we're continuing our conversation on just random movies that we've watched in the last month. And I believe we left off, I think we just kind of ended the conversation with Spencer, so.
It's worth checking out, it seems like.
Yeah, it definitely is. I highly recommend checking it out if you would like to. It is currently playing at Film Scene. Unfortunately, I cannot remember the location off the top.
At the Chauncey, I think.
It might have moved to the Ped Mall by now.
Somewhere at Film Scene.
Yeah, but it's at Film Scene. Check it out if you would like to. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, one movie, this technically I haven't seen in the last month, but hopefully I will see it again this weekend, because Best Buy has the Black Friday deal, and I'd like to go pick up the 4K. Spiral from the Book of Saw. I saw that earlier this year, and I know I mentioned back in like the springtime, oh, maybe that's one we could talk about, but we just never got around to it. It's an interesting Saw film. I don't know. Have you seen any of the Saw films?
I've never seen a Saw film.
Well, I think you can imagine what they're like. The first one, interesting student film. I think it's a long, not student film, but like, another film made kind of like The Evil Dead a little bit, made by like people who had a bit of a budget and they were, you know, very inexperienced. That one's interesting. And then Saw 2 and 3 are okay. And Saw 6 is actually not as bad. But then Saw 7 or whatever it was, Saw 3D was one of the worst films I've ever seen.
Really?
It's truly terrible. It became like those like Law and Order shows that you'd see on like daytime TV and you're like, oh,
so it's like a Lifetime movie?
Yeah, a little bit like that. It was pretty bad. And so Jigsaw a couple years ago, I don't really remember too much of it. But Spiral, I thought it was very interesting because the trailers are actually really good. I love those trailers. And you're getting Chris Rock and Sam Jackson to do a Saw movie. That's such an interesting choice. The movie itself, it's like the filmmakers lost motivation halfway through to make a good movie, it felt like. I do want to give it the benefit of the doubt, and I'll rewatch it because there are some people that really liked it. I thought it was very middle of the road, okay. But the ending is terrible. The ending is one of
That's why I've heard. The ending I don't know the ending, but I've heard very bad things.
So stupid. Like, I just remember sitting in the theater and my girlfriend was next to me and then my brother and his friend were next to me. And like everyone in that group just let out a moan. I was like, oh my goodness. Like, this is what the last 90 minutes has been building up to. It's just, it sucks. I wish Sam Jackson was in it more. His role is kind of just limited to dad. So that's
He's a dad?
Yeah, he plays the dad of Chris Rock. He's like the retired police chief. Chris Rock is great in it. I think he's very funny and I really like him as an actor. But yeah, the movie itself, I want to see it again, but I thought it was okay.
Interesting. Yeah, I've never seen a Saw film, so I don't have any... I have nothing to like say about it. But I just remember seeing trailers for it, because also when Spiral came out, that's when I first started working at a movie theater over the summer. And that was just the one that like everyone was going to see, because it was before Quiet Place 2 was released, so that was like the only big movie at the time. I remember going into the theater to like clean it, and I remember seeing the credits and they was playing like this loud like rap song. Yeah. I was like, what does this have to do with Saw? That's the only thing I know about the movie.
I must admit, I was listening to that song literally an hour ago. It's like a 21 Savage song, whoever that is, I don't know. They did the over credit song, because sometimes artists do that,
right?
But what was most disappointing about it was it really kind of had the potential to be a movie like Seven, where it's like kind of super dark and gritty, and it could have reinvented the genre, the Saw genre, but it kind of just fell back into, you know, what the Saw movies did, which seemed very cheap and kind of just disposable.
Disposable.
But I'm only going to pick up the 4K because I can't say how much, but it's a really good deal. And I want to, again, see the movie and maybe give it the benefit of the doubt now that I know what the twist is, even though it's stupid. But And the writer actually follows me on Twitter, which is funny. But
interesting.
Yeah, other than that, I'd like to see maybe a sequel to it if they got, like, I hate to say it because, again, I know the writer's never going to listen to this. If they got a new team to come in.
A new team.
I think they brought back, like, Saw veterans who had done a couple of the movies before. And it just seemed like if you brought in, like, new fish, I guess, like, it would have been a breath of fresh air for someone who's, like, hungry to revitalize this genre. And I think, too, a lot of people are turned off from the Saw genre because it's so dark and gritty. Like,
yeah.
I don't want to say, like, specific words, but you can kind of picture, like, the gross needles or, like, you know...
The traps.
You can kind of... I think that turns off a lot of people, but if you make a Saw movie that's very, like, kind of fun and vibrant, I think you would get a lot of people that were actually, like, super hyped about it.
Yeah, so, I think that's one of the main reasons why I avoided Saw movies for the good majority of my life was just because of that, but I'm open to seeing them now.
Yeah.
But there's just so many at this point.
Luckily, they're all... I binged them back in the spring, and again, I think some of them, like... The first, second, third, and sixth are worth seeing. And I think Spiral's worth seeing too, but then there's some like you can just skip because they're pretty bad.
And how many Saw movies are there?
I think there's 9 right now altogether. And they're doing 10 apparently, and a TV show. So it's one of those franchises where you can make them for so cheap and you will always get your money back no matter what because people will go see them.
Kind of like the Blumhouse movies in a
way.
Yeah,
Blumhouse movies, yeah. But Blumhouse has a very interesting, I'm sure we can't even say it on air, but they have a very interesting way they actually make their films.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Which I think it's actually, I mean, good on Jason Blum and that
It's kind of genius actually.
It's really genius. And then for the sequels that those kind of, you know, the Halloween movies or whatever else they've done, they do it very differently. But it's a great idea.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm looking back at my Letterboxd account just to see what else I've seen, because admittedly I don't remember what I've seen in the last month. I'm just trying to think of something that's worth talking about. Two films that I saw in the same day. I did a double feature of this at Film Scene at the Chauncey. I did a double feature of Belfast, which is the latest film by Kenneth Branagh, and A Clockwork Orange by Stanley Kubrick. So, because they re-released it at Film Scene at the Chauncey on a 4K restoration. It looked really, really beautiful too. And Belfast was, it's about, I'm going to pull it up actually real quick so I can give a plot synopsis and who starred in it. I should have done this earlier. And now this is very, very awkward.
I'll say I haven't seen the movie myself, but I was very surprised it was directed by Kenneth Branagh. Because I looked at the description, and then he did, like, one of the Thor movies or something, and I was like, this is...
Kenneth Branagh has made a lot of
And he's
movies,
an actor.
Yeah.
He was, what was he, the bad guy? Tenet.
Tenet, yeah. He's made a lot of movies. He's made Shakespeare stuff like Hamlet, and then he's done Thor. He did the god-awful Artemis Fowl movie from last year.
I never saw that. Very bad.
Very, very bad movie. But, Belfast, it's basically a coming-of-age story about a young boy and his family living in Belfast, Ireland during the 60s. So there's like a lot of, there's kind of like a cultural conflict going around. It's a very personal film for Branagh too, because he based a lot of it off of his real life experiences as a child. And you could sense that throughout the movie too. It comes from a very personal place, and also it's shot beautifully. It's shot in black and white, and they also play with color too. But it's overall a very Oscar baity film. Like,
really?
I would not be surprised one bit if this gets nominated, if not wins Best Picture. Not saying I want it to win, just because I think there's better movies out there, but this is kind of like Green Book in a way, where it's very crowd-pleasing in its simplicity, but it's ultimately a harmless movie. There's nothing worth getting angry over, because the movie's still good. Like, I enjoyed myself watching it, but I was just like, yeah, if this wins Best Picture, it's like there's other movies that are much more deserving of this award than that, to tell you the truth. But in no way it's a bad movie. There's a lot of good things about it. Like, performances are really good. It has some of the stars include like Judi Dench, Jamie Dornan, Catriona Balfe, and Sirian Hines, for example. It's a good cast. It's a very simple story.
I don't know if it's one I'll ever check out in my free time unless we decide to review it for the podcast. But I kind of heard the same thing that you kind of just said. It's like, it could be the winner for Best Picture, because usually the movies that win Best Picture are pretty predictable. You know exactly what it's going to be. The only one I can really think of in recent times that was kind of like, oh my God, that one was Shape of Water. But year there was so much that was nominated. So,
I mean, admittedly, Green Book was one where I was surprised it won, because I thought Black Panther was going to win.
You thought Black Panther was going
to
win?
Not that I wanted it to win, but it's like...
Because it's the most crowd-pleasing.
It was the most crowd-pleasing. It definitely, like, it made the most cultural impact, too. And, I mean, I wanted Roma to win, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was surprised that Green Book won.
Oh, I can't believe I forgot to say this. The biggest surprise.
Parasite. Oh,
Parasite.
I knew Parasite was winning.
To say that. Yeah, that I think shocked, I mean, almost everyone, because no one expected that. I mean, people wanted it to win, but I don't think anyone actually thought it was going to.
Not me. I knew it was going to win.
100% deserved all those accolades.
Yep, most definitely. That came out about 2 years ago at
Film
Scene.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I still remember that day vividly, and I actually have the Blu-ray in my bag right now because I'm bringing
it back. Just
carry
it everywhere with you?
Yeah, I carry it everywhere with me. It's like, oh, you ever see Parasite? Here. No. Yeah. I buy 20 of them. I leave them around park benches like Matt Farley does.
That's funny. How was Clockwork Orange on the big screen?
Oh, Clockwork Orange was excellent in theaters. Clockwork Orange, for those that don't know, it's directed by Stanley Kubrick. It's about a teenage boy named Alex who's obsessed with ultraviolence. He gets thrown in jail for a crime, and then he discovers he can get out of jail by subjecting himself to a technique called the Ludovico technique, which erases his free choice. And Clockwork Orange is one of my favorite movies. I never thought I'd get the chance to see it in theaters. And I remember I found out after I saw Eternals on the Film Scene website. I'm just like, I need to go see this. Yeah. And I'm glad I did, because it was not only just as good as when I first saw it, but seeing it in the theater was like, wow, I can't believe I'm actually here. Just because it's one of those movies where it proves why movie theater should still be around. Like the images, the music, especially with the music too.
The music's great, though.
Yeah, it's all like Beethoven classical music, and it plays such a big role in the film. And just hearing that on the in the surround sound, like the images on the screen, they're like, it's striking in a way. Yeah. And like they did a really good job with that restoration too. Like it's a very clear looking film. But also too, since it's not since a lot of the sets in Clockwork Orange were actually shot on location and practically, it doesn't look, you can't, like, the effects don't really like age. Because I remember when I saw I saw something recently in the I can't remember off the top of my head. I'm blanking. Oh, like Wizard of Oz, for example. I saw that in theaters and it was amazing in the theater. But since it was a 4K restoration, you could see like some of the effects.
Yeah.
Like how they worked. Like, oh, when the witch disappears, like you literally see her like go down the elevator shaft.
Oh.
And so it's one of those things where like, you could see like how the effects were done right in the open, just because back then image quality wasn't that great. It's not like that in Clockwork Orange, just because it was all shot on location with limit. It had a very small budget for a Kubrick film at the time too, especially coming off of 2001: A Space Odyssey. And yeah, it was excellent. It's one of those movies that the more I think about, and the more I see, I appreciate more and more. It's like it's one of those.
Yeah, I think for me personally, Kubrick is my favorite director. I just love him. Like, I mean, he's done some of his earlier films are not really that good, like Fear and Desire.
Fear and Desire.
Not a good movie.
No.
Or Killer's Kiss, not really that good. Spartacus, it's fine, but it's like one of those movies where like you just got to see it just to say you've seen it. Like,
that's the only Kubrick film I haven't seen.
Yeah, just watch it to be like, oh, I've seen all of Kubrick's filmography. Yeah. And then you never really need to see it again. It's fine, but it's like 3 hours long.
Mm-hmm.
I love Kubrick. I think he's just a masterful director. Probably not a great person, but yeah, A Clockwork Orange, I think, is one of his better films. It's deeply disturbing.
It is.
I'm very surprised it didn't get an NC-17 rating. Specifically, I can't say the scene, but I can say the singing in the rain scene.
I think it did get an X.
Really?
I think it did get an X rating originally, but then
I think they had to like cut some scenes down.
They cut some scenes down.
I think obviously they've released probably many cuts of the film where those scenes were extended.
Yeah, so when they re-released it, he cut out like a couple seconds out of it to get an R rating. But then as like the MPAA changed, they looked at the original cut and be like, you know what, this is R. Because it was released in 1971. It's turning 50 this year, which is incredible.
That's crazy.
And admittedly, there's very few films that are as disturbing as Clockwork Orange, but there's definitely more violent films out now that are still rated R. So, I mean, even some PG-13 films debatably are more violent than Clockwork Orange, but it's more what you don't see in that movie is what really gets under my skin, especially that certain scene. Even like 50 years later, just the first like 30 minutes of Clockwork Orange is just, it's like a full on, just like, I was about to say another word, but it wouldn't be very appropriate. But it strikes your senses in a way where it's just, in a way, Titan kind of followed a similar way of like just throwing all the crazy stuff in the beginning,
slower in the second half.
Slower in the second half while also exploring more of the themes of the film through that way.
Yeah.
So Yeah, like Clockwork Orange is my second favorite Kubrick film behind The Shining.
Oh, I mean, The Shining is. I actually rewatched that recently. That is just a masterful.
It is.
Masterful.
That's film. A top 10
it's,
for me.
I guess this is a good transition, but it's one of those films where like I watch it because I love The Shining. It's one of my favorite movies. I watch it and I'm like, it's good. There are some scenes that, you know, we hear all the stories about how he directed Shelley Duvall and mm-hmm. Jack Nicholson, especially with Jack Nicholson where you watch his acting and you're like, it's a little robotic. Like the scene that always like I was thinking about this recently where he's like looking at his room in the hotel and he's talking to the Stuart Ullman character and he's like, yeah. Cozy. And then he's like, they look at the room for the kid and he's like, perfect for a child. And it's very robotic, but I'm like, it first of all adds to his character kind of going crazy.
Right.
But The Shining for me is one of those films where I watch it and I'm like, okay, yeah, it's creepy. But then I start thinking about it more after it and I'm like, well, that's really disturbing, actually. Like, just the general plot alone about a guy going, getting cabin fever, essentially, mm-hmm. and wanting to, you know, do terrible things to his family. But then you have to add in the whole ghost element about all of that. Like, the scene, I think a super creepy scene is where he's, like, just walking down the hallway, and he walks into the ballroom, and, like, there is everybody that's supposed to be dead from, yeah. like, 60 years earlier. I think that scene is just so disturbing to me. And it always, I'm getting goosebumps now just thinking about it, because it always freaks me out. How that film just works because of the plot.
It works so much without showing you a lot of exactly. stuff. Like there's really only spoiler, but the movie's been out for like yeah. 40 years. There's one murder pretty much that you see on screen.
Which that's a terrifying scene.
It is, yeah. It's really terrifying, but it shows that you don't need violence like every 5 seconds to be a scary film. Like The Shining is my personal favorite horror film
yeah.
too, because like just everything about it works. And it's one of those movies too where it is such a dense jigsaw puzzle or Rubik's Cube of a film. Like there's literally every single frame, there's something to interpret or get out yeah. of, which is incredible. I mean, it's like it in my eyes, it's Kubrick's ultimate masterpiece, just because like every single element of that movie has so many layers to it. Like there's a really good unfortunately I'm blanking on the guy's name, but there's a guy on YouTube who literally spent like years just analyzing The Shining wow. and finding like new things like in every way possible. Like one is like the optical illusions and the carpets of the Overlook, yeah. not just the hallway, but like in every single room. I'm just like, oh my goodness.
You know, I learned this recently. Kubrick would like mess with the viewers by like moving things around in the background during each shot. So there's a scene where Shelley Duvall's character comes into Jack Nicholson while he's writing and he's like really mean to her. If you know the scene.
Yeah.
And so in the background behind Jack Nicholson, there's a chair. Like there's just a regular chair and like a table next to it. And they would keep cutting from Jack Nicholson to Shelley Duvall during the scene. And halfway throughout the conversation, the chair just disappears. And now really? some people make jokes and they theorize. They're like, oh, it's probably missing because...
A continuity error.
Yeah, something. Because Jack Nicholson would get so mad at Stanley Kubrick for making him do the takes over and over again. He got up and smashed the chair and they couldn't find a replacement. So they just said, oh, well, you know, okay. But then there are other people that are like, oh, well, they're doing that to mess with you. I think another thing too, and I'm sure this guy's probably picked it up, is that they would change the way the carpet would be organized. Like
yes.
which way it would face because it would mess with the viewer's mind while they're watching Danny big wheel throughout the hotel. So it's a very intricate film. Like there's so much in it.
And it blows my mind too that like when it first came out, it was not a hit.
It got nominated for like Razzies.
Yeah, Razzie for Worst Director, which is insane, but it's probably just because of the bad publicity of Kubrick being a control freaking perfectionist, honestly. But
it sucks that, I mean, in my opinion, the greatest scene in the whole movie is the most controversial scene.
Yeah.
The 127 takes or whatever. Mm-hmm. That scene is pure cinema. It is so good. The lines, the way that you can clearly tell Shelley Duvall and Jack Nicholson behind the scenes are going crazy because of how many times they've done this. Like, it is just a wonderful scene.
It is, yeah. I mean, the whole movie is full. Like, it's one of those movies where it's like, even now that I'm thinking about it, I'm just thinking about scenes. I'm just like, that is a perfect scene.
There's a really good documentary, actually, that was directed by Kubrick's daughter. It's called
Making the Shining. Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say Room 237.
I've never seen that, but I've heard it's bad.
It's terrible. Terrible really? Movie. It's so, because like, I know I talked about just like how The Shining is about interpretation and like theory of just like all the stuff that's going on. But the stuff that these people say is just flat out nonsense.
Really?
Honestly, at least in my eyes, it's like they reach so far and they don't really have a lot of good evidence to support it.
Huh.
At least in my opinion, because like they even talk about, like a lot of theories, it's not like stuff about like, oh, it's about how Kubrick faked the moon landing, or it's about like the death of Native Americans. It's not stuff like that. There's like other stuff, like Kubrick's face is like spray painted in the clouds of the opening shot. I'm like, what are you talking about?
I don't know about that.
And yeah, it's stuff like that. It's like, oh, it's about like the Minotaur. There's like a Minotaur poster. I'm like, it's a dude skiing. Like, how do you see a Minotaur? I'm sorry, I don't get it.
One thing actually I learned recently, and who knows how far reaching this is, but it's interesting, is that in that photo at the very end of the movie, in one of the very distant parts, you can see Pinocchio in it. Like, Kubrick
Disney's Pinocchio?
Because Kubrick wanted to make a Pinocchio film.
Yes, he did. And so that's what AI, artificial intelligence, was going to be.
Really?
Yeah, because now we're going down another rabbit hole. But basically, AI, artificial intelligence, was directed by Steven Spielberg.
But it was going to be Kubrick.
It was going to be a Kubrick film. And apparently, he wanted that to be like a sci-fi version of Pinocchio. And it's like, it was like the only time when he wanted to actually try and make a film more for younger audiences, kind of to be like Spielberg in a way.
Yeah.
Whereas later Spielberg tried to emulate Kubrick in some of like his films in the 90s.
Yeah.
In terms of like their naturals. And like Schindler's List has a lot of Kubrick elements in terms of like its cinematography and also just the way it handles all its themes and all that jazz. But
yeah,
it's really interesting.
If you look at that photo, Pinocchio is apparently in the photo. And I was like, I don't know, because it mostly gives it away because of the long nose. But apparently Kubrick's in the background of that photo as well. But did you know he used to do complex mathematics in his free time?
Kubrick?
Yeah.
No.
It makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense.
He would like do like intricate calculus problems just for his spare time because he was that kind of guy.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wait, so what were we talking? Oh, yeah, Making of the Shining.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
That was a really good documentary. I watched that a couple days ago as well. I've seen it, you know, in clips from YouTube many, many times, but to actually sit down and watch the whole thing through, which it's very short.
It's like 30 minutes, yeah.
Yeah, 30 minutes. It's very good. I wish we had more of that film.
Yeah, that could be like a whole movie on its own.
There's that question of like, if you could go back in time to any movie set, what would you choose? I'd choose The Shining. Like, I think just hearing about all those production things that went on behind the scenes about Shelley Duvall and Kubrick getting into fights and her having a panic attack and Jack Nicholson and how I think he behaved like a gentleman, but just seeing how he would get into character, you know, and all these kind of things about how Kubrick would direct, I think that'd be just so fascinating to see.
Yeah, that'd be up there. Like, I'd have to sit and think about that. I've actually never had that question before.
Really?
That's a good question. Like, because there have been many times where it's like, I wish I could go back in time to see a movie in the theater, like when it first came out. But I've never heard like, oh, I want to be on the movie set.
One of the other popular answers I've heard people say is the set of The Room.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about that. But we have The Disaster Artist for that reason.
Which is a masterful film as well.
It is. Excellent film. Check it out if you would like to.
Yeah. What else have you seen recently, Matthew?
Okay, I am looking here. This is actually a short film. And this short film has been getting a ton of critical praise. It came out last week, and it is All Too Well, the short film, which is a music video / short film of Taylor Swift's extended song All Too Well. And it's basically about a troubled couple's like romance as it like they blossom, but then it sort of like falls apart. And then it stars Sadie Sink from Stranger Things.
Oh, yeah.
She plays Max, and Dylan O'Brien. And then they play the couple, and then it shows like their relationship sort of rising and then crumbling. And then we see Sadie Sink grow up, and she turns out to be Taylor Swift, and she writes like this book about her relationship. And it has like on Letterboxd, it has like a 4.5 average score, which is crazy, but it's probably because a lot of Taylor Swift fans are like, oh, Taylor Swift, 5 stars. And like it's good. Like, I'm not gonna say it's bad in any way, because it really isn't. It's really well shot, but it feels, to me, it just felt like a really long music video. I didn't really see what was so special about it, or like why everyone was like going crazy. Because I've kind of seen this stuff before, and it's like the acting is fine, but I don't know. It's like, because I remember everyone's like, you gotta see this short. It's like, it's amazing. I'm like, okay, fine. It's like 15 minutes. Sure, I'll check it out. I'm just like, it's cool, I guess. I think that was just my Letterboxd review. It's like, it's cool.
Yeah, that's surprising that it has such a high Letterboxd rating. I mean, I know, I think Parasite holds the reins for being the highest rated or something, but something like that. But this is very, I mean, this is never going to get anywhere near that, but I'm surprised it's so high.
Yeah. And I don't want to say it's biased, but I think a lot of Taylor Swift fans probably rated it 5 stars because it's Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
Because she's one of those artists where it's like her fans are very devoted, kind of like I've noticed like Beyonce as well. And it's like, I don't have any problem with Taylor Swift or Beyonce. I think their music is fine. But like their fans, it's just like, if you put anything on it, it's like if Taylor Swift made a short film of just paint drying on a wall and it's like a Taylor Swift film, I think that would have gotten like a 4.5 average rating too.
Of recent memory, this was maybe about a year or two ago, there's a filmmaker, you know who he is, David F. Sandberg.
Yes.
He did something hilarious. So he makes
YouTube videos.
So he makes YouTube videos every now and then. He doesn't as much anymore because he's focused on like the Shazam movies. But he occasionally every like 4 or 5 months will. And he made one. And it was a 4 hour long YouTube video called I Flip You Off for 4 Hours.
Yeah.
And he obviously didn't do it for 4 hours. He just looped himself standing in front of his camera, sticking both his middle fingers up with like a stern face. And he looped it and it was like 4 hours long. And so somehow, I don't know if he did it or if like a fan did it, it got added to Letterboxd.
Added to Letterboxd.
It was higher rated than Parasite for like a whole day.
Yeah.
Because everyone was going and just putting 5 stars because Parasite's not like 5.0 or whatever.
No.
This was literally for like a good like 24 to 48 hours, the highest rated thing on Letterboxd until they went and took it down.
You know, at one point, All Too Well was the highest rated.
Really?
It was like at a 4.8 at one
point.
Wow,
that's crazy.
Yeah, Parasite is at 4.6, but also it's the most... It's the most watched. Yeah, like according to Letterboxd, like 1.4 million members have seen it.
Yeah.
So, but that's not everyone on the planet, obviously, because not everyone on the planet has Letterboxd. And I know we've been talking a lot about Letterboxd, but Letterboxd is a social media site where you can rate and review films. It's a really good site.
It's like Facebook and Instagram for movies.
Yeah, there's a lot of memes and also just a lot of cringe, but if you dig through that, you'll find actually some really good criticism on there.
Yeah.
So check it out if you would like to. It's a pretty cool website.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of what else I've seen recently. I watched The Muppets Christmas Carol. I was hesitant to talk about that, but I watched
it. I like The Muppets Christmas Carol.
Yeah, it's okay. Like, I think it's pretty harmless and sweet. Michael Caine he's just a true gentleman. He's always great in all of his films. But yeah, I thought it was fine. The music isn't really my favorite of the Muppets movies. Like, it's not really memorable to me, in my opinion. But yeah, I think it's harmless for what it is. It's okay.
Yeah, Muppet Christmas Carol, it's not my favorite Muppet film. And I didn't see it growing up. I watched it for the first time, I think, when Disney Plus came out. But yeah, it's not even my favorite. If anything, because Disney has made 3 adaptations of A Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
They did The Muppet Christmas Carol, then Mickey's Christmas Carol, which is the animated one from the 80s, and then they did the Jim Carrey, Robert Zemeckis one, which is actually, in my opinion, a very underrated and overlooked movie.
Really?
I think it's really, really good in terms, because it is very faithful to the story, and it's really dark, but also Christmas Carol is a very dark story, and the motion capture is... Like, motion capture is kind of, I have, like, mixed feelings about it, but they do a really good job with that. It doesn't look really spooky or scary, because it was from the same people that did Polar Express, which I know Polar Express was the first of its kind, but man, that animation ages like milk. It looks disgusting, sorry.
It's not
inviting the slice, but Christmas Carol, actually, they do a good job with the motion capture, and I really like that movie. But Muppet Christmas Carol, it's very fun, and they add sort of like that Muppet flair to it. I don't think it's the best retelling of the Charles Dickens story, but it's cute.
Yeah, I think it's okay. I like, because now some of the Muppet stuff, especially because we just watched Muppet's Haunted Mansion a couple weeks ago, the Kermit voice has never aged well, I think, because whoever did the Kermit voice in that, I think Brian Henson was dead, or not Brian Henson, Jim Henson was dead.
Yeah, Jim Henson died like a couple years before that movie.
But the Kermit voice was still good on that. I liked it.
Yeah.
So, which it's because I just mentioned Brian Henson, that's his son, and he directed one of the other Muppet movies. I'm not sure which one off the top of my head, but you want to know what else he directed?
Happy Time Murders.
Happy Time Murders.
Which is terrible.
Okay. Happy Time Murders, it was an interesting idea.
Interesting idea, yeah.
I think the first act is really good, because it sets up this interesting idea of like, oh, who's going around killing these puppets? It's kind of, you know, Muppets mixed with R-rated. And then it just goes into a downward spiral of terribleness.
See, I remember when I saw the trailer for Happy Time Murders, I was actually very intrigued, because it's like, I mean, I really like the Muppets. And we talked about this in the Muppets Haunted Mansion episode. It was cool to see like, oh, it would be really funny to make an R-rated Muppet film.
Yeah.
But they just went down the most frat boy type humor. It wasn't funny. It honestly felt like an insult to the Muppet franchise and also to Jim Henson. The fact that it was written and directed by his son just made it even more insulting. Like, I'm sure Jim Henson was rolling in his grave when that movie came out. But because for me, it's like, it's a mixture of it. It's not an interesting movie. It's really slow and boring in the beginning. And then the humor just is so terrible and so juvenile.
One of the final jokes in the movie, if not the final joke, is idiot says what? And the, you know, the mean character, the mean detective says what? And I'm like, oh, that's so just 12-year-old humor. It's like, it could have been so much better.
It's like forgettable too. Like I really, like I hated that movie, but also it's one where it's like, I hated it, but it didn't stick with me. Because there's movies that I've hated, but like I will never forget it just because it left that negative an impact. Happy Time Murders is like, yeah, it was awful, but it's like it's not even worth remembering.
What sucks about that too is tell you, Matthew, to go back and rewatch it. Sadly, I own the Blu-ray, but it's been years since I've seen it. It's riddled with like continuity errors and plot holes.
I'm sure.
In the third act, especially, it is crazy at how like off the walls it gets. A funny story I remember about that was my friend and I were going to go see it, and we had dates to the thing, and then the dates didn't know what movie we were seeing, and it came out around the same time as Crazy Rich Asians.
Yes.
It came out the same weekend.
I remember that.
And so our dates were like, what movie are we seeing? And my friend and I, we got there and we had the tickets already, and we were like, oh, we're seeing the Happy Time Murders. And like the look on their faces, they didn't even say no. They just said, oh, okay, we're going to go see Crazy Rich Asians. You guys have fun with that. And we were like,
well, they chose the better movie.
Yeah. Luckily we didn't buy the tickets. So for them. So
yeah. We're going to lead into a quick grant spot, and we'll be right back with more Bijou banter. Welcome back to Bijou Banter, and we are continuing our conversation on movies that we've seen recently. And were we still on Happy Time Murders?
No, I think we've said it all about it. Like it's kind of one of those movies, I guess maybe it's best to watch it once if you'd like to, just to say you've seen it, like what it's all about. But again, I think if you choose not to, you'll live a fine life.
Yeah, honestly, I would not recommend seeing that, especially if you are a Muppet fan. It hurts.
It's an insult. Yeah.
It hurts. It's kind of like when we talked about Eerie and the Witch. I'm like, oh, this, as a Ghibli fan, like this movie just straight up hurts.
I was thinking about that movie recently, and I was like, the things we had to do for Bijou Banter sometimes.
Yeah, no, because actually, this is a good segue for Ghibli. I rewatched Castle in the Sky for one of my film classes, and I'm just like, wow, the artistic beauty and also just the storytelling in that movie is just pure Ghibli.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking back to Eerie and the Witch, and I was like, what even happened here? Like, they didn't even try. And we talked about this on a separate episode, but we already went into it. It's just like, it had no sense, it had barely a story, horrible animation, and horrible characters too.
Yeah, I don't remember much of that movie. It's crazy to think that was almost a year ago.
Yeah.
But we never really review a lot of like kid type movies for Bijou. Very rarely we do. Like, I mean, we did the Lego Star Wars special and Muppet special, or Muppet Halloween. But yeah, when we do sometimes talk about kid movies, it sucks when we have to talk about like the bad ones, because we have to put ourselves through that at, you know, 20 years old. We're like,
like Space Jam 2. We knew going in that was going to be a train wreck, and boy, was it.
Yeah.
Really the only one that like the only kids movie, debatably kids movie that we talked about that we were kind of just like on was Luca.
Yeah. That was a disappointing film. Were you on that episode?
I was, yeah. Yeah. I was until I saw Last Night in Soho, that was the most disappointing film I saw all year.
We talked about a couple kids, like Into the Spider-Verse, Soul, those were great.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
You saw Titan, right?
I did see Titan. It was okay.
Yeah, that was all right.
I this is just another horror movie that it's personally is not my cup of tea. Like I thought the craziness was crazy, but then it kind of just took a very slow turn for the second half of the film. And I was like, okay, like I can see why there are some people that enjoy this kind of horror that, you know, maybe throws in like these deeper meanings or like, I don't know. For me, I hate to say that, like I love Blumhouse because sometimes Blumhouse makes pretty crappy films, but it kind of sucks because I do like those, jump scare type movies. It's more fun for me to watch those instead of like sitting down and just like, what does this all mean about life and how do I question reality and like, you know, all these types of things. But I think it's okay. It's just not one I personally need to see again.
I can see. I remember we had a brief conversation about that, and you said it was boring, and
I thought it was a little boring.
I was very surprised actually, just because a lot of crazy stuff happens in it. And
I thought if the whole movie was like the first act, then I probably would have given it a higher rating than I did. I think I went 4 out of 10 on it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. It's pretty low, but I was a little bored while watching it.
Okay.
I remember during the last act, I was doing dishes.
What else did I see recently? I'm just checking here. What is worth talking about on here? I'm looking. Oh, here's one that I saw. I recently I saw a film called The Piano, which...
Oh, is that Harvey Keitel?
Yes, it has Harvey Keitel, Holly Hunter, Sam Neill, and a young Anna Paquin.
Which she won an Oscar for.
She won an Oscar for when she was 11, which is insane. And, yeah, and
makes me feel great about myself.
Yeah, it's like we're 20 and we're just talking about... We're talking about movies on a college radio show. Yeah. And Anna Paquin won an Oscar at 11.
We could either be winning Oscars or we could be making short films like Bo Burnham, but no, here we are.
Yeah, but The Piano, it was written and directed by Jane Campion, who is about... She won the Palme d'Or for this movie, actually.
Really?
Yeah. I think she was like one of the first women to ever win the Palme d'Or at Cannes. And it's about a psychologically mute mother who travels to New Zealand to marry in an arranged marriage with a frontiersman. And she's also a pianist, too. So it's a really beautiful movie. And I've always been interested in this film also because Jane Campion is getting ready to release her next film, Power the Dog, on Netflix in a couple weeks. And it is also going to be playing at Film Scene at the Chauncey, Film Scene on the Pet Mall, excuse me, next Wednesday before Thanksgiving. So check that out if you would like to. But it was very, it's a very simple story, but they handle the subject matter and also the emotions really well. It is very beautiful. And also Holly Hunter, who won an Oscar for her performance, she really doesn't say anything for the whole movie because she plays a mute woman. But it's a very moving performance just because, like it's all in her face. It's all in her, like, body language, too. Mm-hmm. And even Anna Paquin, too, was really good in it. Honestly, I don't know if it was like, best supporting actress worthy, but it was a very good child performance. Yeah. And I did really like it overall. So
I haven't seen it, but it's up there with those movies that my mom constantly recommends to me, like, every 4 to 6 months, she'll be like, have you seen this movie? And I'm like, I haven't gotten around to it yet. And then I get to hear the whole plot of the movie. But yeah, it's on my watch list. So hopefully I'll get around to it at some point.
Yeah, I would recommend it. It is a bit of a slower movie, but it's worth it in the end.
Yeah. Okay, here's a good question, Matthew. Yep. What movies are you hoping to check out over break?
Oh, well, I would like to check out Power of the Dog because I'll be going back home and it'll probably be playing in some theaters near me. Other stuff include House of Gucci, which is the latest Ridley Scott film that's coming out over Thanksgiving. Ghostbusters Afterlife just came out today, which I'm not really looking forward to it, but as a Ghostbusters fan, I kind of want to check it out.
Really? You're not just going to wait? Like,
I might check it out, honestly, because it looks interesting. It looks better than... Okay, I'll be honest. I'm actually one of the few people that didn't mind the 2016
version.
I didn't
mind it either. Like, it doesn't hold up with rewatch. But...
No, but it's like people think it's like, oh, it's the worst thing ever. It's like, dude, there are really way worse movies you could be watching. Like, there were actually some moments in that movie that I thought were funny.
Yeah, I think people just said, again, that was one of the movies about 3 years ago I got on Black Friday along with Happy Time Murders or something, and I did a double feature of Happy Time Murders and Ghostbusters. It was a disappointing day, but it's sadly one of those movies when I saw Ghostbusters in theaters, I was like, okay, this is actually not too terrible. I think some people just had an agenda with it for a very stupid reason, because anybody can be a Ghostbusters. Like, who cares?
Yeah.
And so I find it funny now that, like, we have men and women Ghostbusters, even though they're kids, and to the best of my knowledge, no one's freaking out about it. So, like, I don't see why anybody cared in the first place, but... it was one I rewatched, and I didn't really think it held up that much. But it's, again, not too terrible.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in a while, but I remember I saw it in theaters. I'm like, it's not too bad, actually. Yeah. I kind of like this. And
it was a good cast.
Yeah, really good cast. And, I mean, Paul Feig is...
Great director.
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of hit or miss, but when he hits it, he makes really good stuff. But yeah, I'll check it out because it looks like it has a pretty good cast. And also... Jason Reitman, Ivan Reitman's son, is directing it too. He also wrote and directed Juno. No, he didn't write Juno. He directed Juno.
Really?
Yeah, he directed Juno. Diablo Cody wrote it, who is a UIL alum.
Yeah, I heard she did not have a good time here.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Apparently, she's not a fan of Iowa. So I know she's listening right now, but yeah, I remember I think I mentioned to someone once, we should get Diablo Cody to come for a Bijou thing. They're like, no, she doesn't like Iowa, but which is sad, but. Yeah, again, it's sadly one of those movies that I think probably I'll just wait till it comes to, like, I don't know, streaming service and I'll check it out. But I just haven't heard good things.
Yeah, two more things that I'm looking forward to. And then, unfortunately, we got to wrap this episode up soon. Unless you want, is there anything that you're excited before?
I'm trying to look at my watch list quickly. I'm excited because I think Hawkeye actually starts
next week. Yes, Hawkeye starts next
week.
That'll
be exciting. Yeah, and I think that's off the top of my head, like the thing that I'm probably most looking forward to.
Yeah, speaking of Disney, I'm looking forward to their next film, Encanto, or Encanto,
Oh,
which I
yeah.
really didn't hear a lot about because I haven't really seen any trailers for it. I saw one trailer when I saw Eternals, and it looks pretty good. But it's Disney, has music from Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Yeah.
It has a good cast too. And then the other one, which is also going to be streaming on Disney Plus, is The Beatles Get Back, which
Oh.
is the Beatles documentary by Peter Jackson, which it was originally going to be a feature film, but then COVID happened. But then they realized, hey, we have so much footage, let's just do a documentary series on Disney Plus. So it's a three-part series. I believe it starts next week. I don't know when, like the exact day, but he's using the same techniques they use for They Shall Not Grow Old, where it's like he's taking all of these archive footage and he's restoring it to look beautiful and immersive. So I'm really looking forward to that. And also, I really like the Beatles in general.
Yeah, who
So
doesn't like the Beatles?
yeah. So yeah, is there anything else that you want to
I
see?
just saw it because this was on my watch list, and I know you saw it. I never got around to this Free Guy. Maybe I'll check that out. I know you. I don't think you were a fan of it, right?
I wasn't a huge fan of it. Like I see why people like it because people are like, oh, it's harmless fluff, but it's like, I don't know, I thought it was kind of stupid.
Yeah, I think again, it's just one of those movies. I'll check it out just to say, oh yeah, I saw Free Guy, but it looks fun, but it kind of strikes me as just another movie where Ryan Reynolds plays Ryan Reynolds,
Yeah,
and you
oh,
can
most definitely. Yeah,
100% expect exactly what's going to
it's like the
happen.
most Ryan Reynolds movie.
I've seen like clips, so like I know like they definitely reference a lot of like Star Wars and Disney stuff, and I know there's like a lot of great cameos in it, but other than that, yeah, who knows? Maybe I'll have a fun time with it, but.
Yeah, who knows?
Oh, and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. I do want to see that because I haven't seen it.
Actually, I haven't seen it either. I got
I
you.
know it's like the quintessential Thanksgiving movie.
I mean, to me, the quintessential Thanksgiving movie
Oh,
is
and
Charlie Brown
Charlie Brown. Well,
Thanksgiving.
yeah, but okay. Adult.
Adult
Adult.
Thanksgiving.
Well,
Yeah.
okay, Charlie Brown, I guess, still, but anyone can watch Charlie
Anyone can
Brown.
watch Charlie Brown. Yeah, it's for all ages.
Yeah.
Much like the holiday season of Thanksgiving, which is a really good holiday. You get to meet up with
Yeah,
family, eat some good
delicious,
food.
scrumptious foods.
Yep.
Pumpkin pie.
Well, that'll wrap up this episode of Bijou Banter. It was a bit of a different episode. We just kind of
Yeah.
went, just it was a, sorry if we rambled or we just kind of, there was just some silence, but
Yeah.
we want to try something different. And hopefully you
I
all
think it
enjoyed this
worked.
episode. Yeah, I think so too. I thought this was pretty fun.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't believe we'll be having an episode next week as
No.
we'll all be out of town, but be sure to tune in the week after that, which we will be talking about probably something really cool that will be playing at Film Scene or other theaters anywhere.
Yeah.
But yeah, until next time, I've been Matthew,
And I've been Orson.
and we will see you all next time. Bye-bye, and happy Thanksgiving.